Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's April 21st, 2015 8th Annual Conference, Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin chaired this 14-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 4, Current M&A Issues in Transactions Involving Hedge Fund Managers. Floyd Whitlin, Cheryl Orr, and Chuck Bogle will discuss current M&A issues and trends in transactions involving hedge fund managers. Now, on to the podcast.
First, let me introduce the panel. I'm Floyd Whitlin. I'm a partner in the Corporate Business Transactions Group at Morgan Lewis. To my right is Cheryl Orr. She's also a partner in the Corporate and Business Transactions Group. And to my left is Chuck Bogle, and he is a partner in our tax practice. Typically, when folks consider an M&A transaction, they usually think of it in terms of the sale of a controlling interest in a target. That's not for the advanced topics. That's the basic stuff. Since we're dealing with advanced topics today, we're going to talk about three other items. First, we're going to be talking about transactions in which there's a sale other than a sale of control or a minority stake in a hedge fund manager. And second, we're going to be talking about other forms of liquidity events for hedge fund managers as an alternative to possible sales of their firms. And these are capital market solutions, and they are principally initial public offerings of hedge fund managers, which we anticipate seeing more of, as well as reverse mergers or other business combinations with publicly traded shells. So with that in mind, with respect to the sale of non-controlling stakes, turn it over to Cheryl.
Good morning. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about sales of less than all of the outstanding equity interests of a fund manager. Given the short amount of time we have, I'm only going to talk about the considerations or issues from a sell side perspective. But if anyone has any questions on sort of the buy side considerations, I'm more than happy to talk to anyone one-on-one. In a sale of less than all of the equity interests of a fund manager, an initial decision that you'll need to make is whether you should sell a controlling interest or a minority interest. There are a variety of factors to consider when making this decision. One is the effect on your pool of potential buyers. You're going to want to have as large of a pool as possible, and there may be more potential buyers for a change of control transaction because the buyer will be able to exercise much more influence if it owns a controlling interest. You might also consider whether it's more important to take some of your money out of the fund now, in which case you may prefer to sell a controlling interest, or to retain more of a share in the long-term upside of the fund, in which case you may prefer to sell a minority interest. Another consideration is how much loss of autonomy in running the business you think you are able to tolerate. And then there are regulatory considerations, such as whether the sale of a controlling interest will trigger more client consent requirements than a sale of a minority interest. And you would also want to consider the impact on your investors and employees. Will your key investors object to a sale of a controlling interest because they want you to continue to be in control? If so, then a sale of a minority interest will still get you some liquidity. And if you sell a controlling interest, you should take into consideration what will happen to your employees and how they'll be treated. Another key consideration for sellers when considering a sale of less than all of their equity interests is governance. How will the fund manager be governed after the closing of the sale? And how much autonomy will the seller be given to run the company post-acquisition? If a seller only sells a minority interest, the seller will retain the most autonomy because it will still be the controlling equity holder, but the buyer will want to have some minority protections, typically in the form of consent rights with respect to specified actions. If a seller sells a controlling interest, the seller will have less autonomy in terms of the governance of the fund manager, unless it specifically contracts otherwise, which I'll discuss in a moment. And in that case, the seller will likely want to have minority protections itself. One side note here is that you want to make sure that all the minority consent rights for either the buyer or the seller are fully vetted by your counsel, as they can raise assignment implications under the Advisors Act and control implications under various banking-related regulations. In a sale of a controlling interest, sellers can still have a great deal of autonomy in terms of the day-to-day operations of the fund manager by contracting separately with the buyer, contractual autonomy, if you will. Buyers will often want the existing fund managers to continue to manage the fund because of their expertise or their track record with the sellers. And so they will enter into a contract with the sellers, for an example, an employment agreement or a management contract. Pursuant to this contract, the sellers will continue to run the day-to-day business of the fund manager. When you're negotiating an autonomy contract, there are a number of issues to consider. How the board or the executive committee will be comprised, how voting will work, and how to deal with deadlocks if there is a tie vote, how key employees and managers will be compensated, for example, through profit participation interests or through bonus pools, who has the ability to hire and fire officers and employees, who has the right to create new funds, change investment strategy, purchase a new business, change key service providers, and if there's an earnout or a non-compete provision, what happens if the buyer wants to acquire, whether directly or indirectly, a competing business? What happens if the buyer suffers a reputational event? Should this trigger a right to put your shares to the buyer or a right to unwind the transaction? These are just a few examples of issues that will need to be taken into consideration in an autonomy transaction. Now, I know I've just breezed through a lot of considerations in a very short amount of time, and I've only selected a few key topics in this area to highlight. So please, if you have any questions about what I've highlighted or any other M&A-related matter, I'm happy to talk to any of you one-on-one.
Thanks, Cheryl. Let's turn to, as I said, an alternative to a sale of either all or substantially all of the manager or a minority stake, as Cheryl was referring to. And that is an initial public offering of securities of a manager. Now, one needs to be very cautious before one undertakes an initial public offering. And you need to carefully weigh the benefits of being a publicly traded company against some of the detriments which result from that. So why would a manager consider becoming a publicly traded company? Well, to some extent, it may have the best of some worlds, and that is it will permit you to retain control of your firm, but at the same time provide you with a not only an existing liquidity event, but a pathway toward future liquidity. Some of the benefits of doing an IPO would be perhaps the valuation one would receive on an IPO may be greater than that which one would receive in a transaction for a private sale. It also will provide you with an opportunity to use your publicly traded security as a currency for both subsequent acquisitions and for compensating your employees. It also will give you access to the markets for future financings, including to finance new strategies or for working capital. The detriments of going public are fairly obvious, and that is you now have a new partner in terms of the Division of Corporation Finance of the Securities and Exchange Commission. You also, if you are exchange listed, you have another partner. You have the exchange. They are looking closely at your activities. You have additional reporting obligations under the Exchange Act. You need to produce audited financial statements. And generally, there is increased transparency in connection with becoming a public company. You also have analysts who will be watching closely your quarter-to-quarter performance. And this will, once again, increase the scrutiny generally that you are under. I'm going to turn to Chuck to describe some tax structures which are used in connection with public offerings of managers.
This is related to tax somewhat, so I'll try to make it as painless as possible. You can see from the chart, this is what's called an Up-C structure, is the one that's listed on the chart. Basically, what we're trying to do here in initial public offerings or public acquisitions is sell off all or a portion of the manager to the public markets, but in a tax-efficient way. This whole area underwent a bit of a sea change around 2006, 2007, when firms such as KKR and Apollo, Fortress and Blackstone all did some variant of this kind of structure accessing the public markets. The goals of the structure are to, well, let's just describe it a little bit. You can see that there's a public corporation, which is sort of the acquisition vehicle. There is a split capital structure, both at the public acquisition vehicle and down at the manager or the limited liability company, typically. The split capital structure offers voting control versus economics. Typically, the existing owners will retain some portion of the voting control for a specified period of time. The economics are sold to the public. The public corporation will acquire an interest in the manager, either if there's a current liquidity desired through a sale by the existing owners, or by a contribution down to the manager for a new interest and use of that money in the existing business. The benefits of doing this, and this is actually one of the simpler structures, as you'll see when we get to the next chart, is that it allows existing owners to retain voting control for all or a period of time. The economics at the operating company level are preserved in that the existing owners, to the extent they have not cashed out, will retain a minority interest in the ongoing economics. They also have, it affords managers the ability to get liquidity through an exchange of their existing interest in the manager for the publicly traded corporation stock. For the public, or for the public corporation, the benefit is obviously there's access to the capital markets. The public corporation is typically structured as a corporation for tax purposes, which means that tax-exempt investors and foreign investors can acquire interests in it without worrying that they're going to end up subject to tax on a net basis in the U.S. or subject to what's called the unincorporated business tax. The public corporation will get a step up in the basis of its assets, in the assets of the manager acquired, principally, which is goodwill, potentially on the initial acquisition, and also as existing managers exchange their interests for stock of the public corporation. The public corporation can amortize essentially that goodwill and reduce taxable income, although the benefit of that is often shared with the managers who dispose of their interests. 85-15 is a typical split, but you can see it other ways. So, you know, 85% of the tax benefit is paid over to the existing managers whose sale generated that tax benefit. For the existing managers, they also maintain flow-through tax treatment until they exchange. So there's no corporate-level tax on their portion of the business's income. Other type of structure that you can see and is significantly more complicated. This can be a helpful structure where you have a significant amount of income generated by the business in the form of a carry. So capital gains, interest dividends, that kind of income. This structure, which is colloquially referred to as the PTP advisor structure, gets access to the capital markets and maintains flow-through treatment of incentive allocations from the subsidiary funds for the public investors themselves, as opposed to the prior structure in which there was a blocker corporation, which typically is going to be subject to tax. The top-level entity, the public entity, is a publicly traded partnership. It's called PTP. It is typically recognizes only the quote-unquote good income, which is interest, dividends, capital gains, and so forth. That income can pass through the top entity to the investors free of any corporate-level tax, generally. The cost is that the bad income from a publicly traded partnership perspective, which is essentially the fee income from the business, has to be channeled through a blocker corporation that's described as management holdco blocker on which corporate tax is imposed. So the cost is that there is corporate tax imposed on the fee income, but the rest of the income can flow through free of tax. This also has, in addition to looking worse, it has complexities in the distributions schemes because the interests have to be fungible.
Thanks. So in the short time we have remaining, let me quickly go through a transaction with a public shell. We recently worked on one where we represented a public shell, sometimes known as a SPAC, in connection with the acquisition of a controlling interest in a manager. Many of you may actually have, are part of firms that invest in SPACs. So we're not talking about the initial public offering side here. We're not going to get into that, but just suffice it to say that one of these shells is a company that's gone public, it's already raised money, and its sole purpose is to make an acquisition using the proceeds from the public offering. And there have been some acquisitions, as I said, of managers. If you are a manager, what are the benefits of going this route? Well, number one, you already have a company that's raised money. That means the cash is already there. The other benefit is it's viewed somewhat differently because it's an acquisition transaction by the SEC than it would be if it were an initial public offering. So it may give you quicker access to becoming a public company. The principal pitfall with these transactions is that there's a concept of the shareholders who invested in the public offering, they have a redemption right. That means they can get their money back when they take a look at the transaction and evaluate whether they effectively want to continue as shareholders of the SPAC post-closing. And there are lots of issues with respect to that redemption. So I said earlier, the benefit of a SPAC is that you have access to a pool of capital which already exists. But as a result of this redemption right, that pool of capital may not actually be there in its entirety at closing. And therefore, you may have gone down a path where you assumed, for example, there was $100 million sitting there for you to use for working capital purposes, to seed new products, et cetera. But when you get to the closing, the redemptions have been so large that you no longer have that money available. And then there's a question of, well, do you really want to proceed with a transaction where all that cash is not available? So that's the principal risk. Thank you.
To listen to other panels from the 2015 8th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.